We have a serious task ahead. We are trying to keep democracy alive. The name of the show, Keeping Democracy Alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dignity of man. And what is that? You know, can you have a foreign policy that treats the rest of the world as less than, that we need to own them and control them and that they better listen to us? Is that going to work for very long? How do you feel about that when people treat you that way? What kind of a foreign policy should the next president of the United States have? And as they say, you know, past is prologue. We're going to take a look today at one of the two contenders who has a tremendous amount of experience in foreign policy, one of the two Democratic contenders, Hillary Clinton, at what her record as Secretary of State and prior to that, her votes in the U.S. Senate, what kind of foreign policy we'd be looking at. Bert Cohen here. This is Keeping Democracy Alive. A poll taken in Iowa just before the presidential caucus found that 70% of Democrats surveyed trusted Hillary Clinton on foreign policy more than Bernie Sanders. One of the few things I guess she has been trusted on. Of course, she did, in fact, serve as Secretary of State from 2009 through 2013. She does have that experience. But what did it yield? And what does her record portend for a Hillary Clinton presidency? Her replacement, John Kerry, has put diplomacy to work and has unquestionably achieved significant results, such as groundbreaking diplomatic breakthroughs with Iran, a new policy toward Cuba. Secretary of Kerry is making real progress on the war in Syria and relations with Russia. Today, we're going to take a real look at the work of his predecessor. What was her approach? And in what shape was the world left from the approach of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State? Who was she? What might foreign policy and defense strategy look like under a Clinton presidency? How might it compare with the foreign policy of people like her mentor, Henry Kissinger, and those in the State Department under the neocon regime of President Bush and Cheney? America is mired today in what looks like perpetual war. Would she bring needed change or more of the same? What do we really need now in terms of foreign policy? Our guest today on Keeping Democracy has performed a fairly thorough examination into the realities of American foreign policy as it relates directly to the tenure of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who, of course, is now challenging Senator Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination for president. Our guest is Nicholas J.S. Davies. Thanks for being with us, Nicholas.
Thank you for having me.
Well, sure. Nicholas Davis is the author of the critically acclaimed Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq, which retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern called the best account so far of the Iraq War, how it happened and why. Nicholas writes about U.S. foreign policy, militarism, and war crimes for Consortium News, Z Magazine, Huffington Post, and other publications. Well, again, Nicholas Davies, I'll call you Nick. What was your purpose in researching and writing this article called Hillary Clinton and the Dogs of War? Why did you write it?
Well, as you said, I saw that poll that 70% of Democrats in Iowa trusted Clinton more than Sanders on foreign policy. And, of course, already knowing a fair bit about the role she's played, I certainly thought that if all of those 70% actually really had a better understanding of the role she has played, I think a lot of them would think twice about about that opinion.
I have to think you're right. I mean, I certainly am a Democrat, no surprise there, and know a lot of Democrats, and there are some people who are supporting her largely because of that foreign policy experience, but I don't think they know. I mean, they know, okay, she was Secretary of State, but it's important to me in this nominating process to really take a look at who the candidates are and what, yeah, it's like buying a product. What are we buying specifically? And in terms of foreign policy, it seems to me there are two basic components, diplomacy and military action. What do you think Hillary Clinton would give us as examples of her use of diplomacy? What do you think the term diplomacy means to Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think when you listen to the way she uses the term diplomacy in referring to her own record, and the instances that she cites to support that, you know, the two that I drew attention to in the article, I think these are the two I've heard her cite in the debates, are her role in the incredibly destructive military operation in Libya, which ended with the sodomization and assassination of its leader, Muammar Gaddafi, and has since plunged that country into complete, intractable, unending chaos. And yet Hillary Clinton hails that as some kind of success. And she talks, and she uses the term diplomacy to refer to the way that she joined an initiative that really began with Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, and ended up forming this bizarre coalition between NATO and the surviving monarchies of the Arab world, you know, from Morocco on one end to Jordan on the other, and of course the King of Saudi Arabia and his colleagues in the Gulf Cooperation Council, all the emirs of the mostly former British protectorates from the Persian Gulf, which in a sort of deal with between the Saudis and the British, when Saudi Arabia conquered that whole area, they kept their hands off these little British bases on the Persian Gulf. So are now, again, part of this group about 10 or 12 surviving in generally absolute monarchies,
yes,
governed by Arab sheikhs and kings.
And I wonder, you know, just aside from the ethics and the morals of such a policy, we here, way across the Atlantic, we don't see it. We don't, you know, feel it directly. But there are millions of people in the Middle East region who know that history about the British in what they did after the end of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, and they feel it. So these Arab monarchies, I wonder how, just in terms of national security, selfish reasons for the United States, how does it go over there? How is it going to affect our future strength and stability in that area when we are seen so clearly as picking up the slack that formerly Great Britain left there and supporting these Arab monarchies. And how does that come into play, as you say, in places like Libya and other places there? I mean, the people there understand it. We may not. But how does, you know, they see, the people on the ground there see who we are backing. How does that affect our, you know, security and strength for the future, do you think?
Well, I'd say, you know, it's all a disaster, really. And I think, you really have to go, in a lot of my writing, I go back to the end of the Cold War as a pivotal moment. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of decisions made in Washington without any real public debate that have taken our country in directions that, if there was a genuine public debate, if the American people were really consulted, you know, what we've ended up with is really the opposite of what most people want. There's an excellent book written in 2006 by Benjamin Page and Marshall Botton, who work for the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And it's called The Foreign Policy Disconnect: What Americans Want from Our Leaders But Don't Get. And what we have got since the end of the Cold War, you know, what we were told, the public debate at that point, revolved around what was generally known as the peace dividend. The fact that, you know, this whole military-industrial complex that had grown up during the Cold War had essentially served its purpose. You know, whether you actually give it credit for, you know, for the demise of the Soviet Union, or whether you attribute that to other completely different cultural and political factors within that part of the world. The fact is that what most of us wanted and expected at that point was that huge war machine with its thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons enough to destroy the world, the U.S. global military presence all over the world, and, you know, these two blocks armed to the teeth facing each other. But that phase had come to an end. And, we were not going to need that anymore. And, in fact, in an article about the U.S. military budget a few months ago, I wrote about a Senate budget hearing committee at which two rather unlikely companions testified. One was Larry Korb, who was Ronald Reagan's Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the other was the infamous Robert McNamara, Kennedy and Johnson's Secretary of Defense. And they both agreed on the extent to which the U.S. military budget could be reduced over the next 10 years to what would now be in inflation, you know, adjusted for inflation to, you know, 2016 dollars, would be less than $300 billion a year. So I think they came up with somewhere around 250, 270 or 80.
Well, looking at the people in the area who know that we support the monarchists there, how do they feel about that? How does that, I mean, looking at long term, you can't win a war unless you have some of the hearts and minds of the people. We could have learned that in Vietnam. You know, Cruz has talked about just seeing if sand would glow for being radioactive. Obviously, that is not going to happen. But in terms of our continued linking up with the Arab monarchies, how is that going to play on the ground there?
Well, I think it's an insane policy. Many of these Arab monarchs are already in trouble. Many of them have faced dissent and revolution over the years from their own people. But the U.S. has a very long history of supporting unpopular, dictatorial regimes.
So why should this be
in that part of the world, but in many other parts of the world too? It's not a way you're ever going to win the hearts and minds of people around the world. And yet, at the same time, there are people, wealthy people in those countries who have a lot of wealth thanks to oil, and have embraced elements of, Western consumerism, unlike American products and that sort of thing. But it's really dreadful that the United States allies in the world are some of the worst regime, and it completely undercuts the whole narrative of humanitarian interventionism.
Right.
So we're intervening in these countries supposedly to overthrow bad regimes and bad rulers who repress and torture their people.
Right.
When at the same time we're supporting plenty of others who are arguably just as bad, or in the case of Saudi Arabia, even worse.
Yeah. And if you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Nicholas J.S. Davies, who's written about Hillary Clinton and the dogs of war, what her history is. And we have, the United States has a long tradition of linking up with the monarchies in the area. I don't know, has Hillary Clinton said anything critical about that? Has any other candidates? I haven't quite frankly seen Bernie Sanders even say anything critical of our partnership with the Arab monarchies. Is she different on that?
I think Bernie Sanders he's sort of playing a tiny game in terms of what he does say about foreign policy. He clearly wants to keep the debate on the areas where he has a stronger, clearer position. I think if you do go to his website and click on issues, there is an issues heading of war and peace, in which he does lay out, I'd say, a pretty clear philosophy. He reminds people of Eisenhower's warning about the
power of the
military-industrial complex.
Right.
Phyllis Bennis recently wrote a piece. I think it may be at The Nation, or I think if you Google her, you can find it, where she has some advice for Bernie Sanders, and what she proposes is that his foreign policy could very neatly be connected with his domestic policy, by saying no wars for the interests of the billionaire class.
Ah, true. That does fit.
And I think that's very good advice from Phyllis Bennis. I think that would very, very neatly sum up what I think a lot of us would like to hear from Bernie Sanders.
No, I'd love to have Phyllis Bennis somewhere in the cabinet, actually, with some real political power. You spoke just a minute ago about that. You use the term humanitarian intervention. You write that Hillary Clinton is squarely in the humanitarian interventionist camp with her close friend and confidant, Madeleine Albright. And you mention that Albright called theirs an unprecedented partnership. Let's look again to past being prologue, Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton being so close. Tell us about Albright's foreign policy when she was Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. I don't really remember that. I remember her style, her rather brash style, but tell us about her policy, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, as with the public sort of view of Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright has come out of the last 25 years very much unscathed and viewed as well, you know, she was the first female Secretary of State, you know, very highly respected. She more recently chaired this whole committee to sort of reshape NATO in the post-Cold War world. But in fact, you know, she played a great role in what we were beginning to talk about before, about the way that U.S. post-Cold War foreign policy went from the hope of realizing peace dividend to actually, you know, really a bipartisan effort to re-legitimize politically, not legally, but politically re-legitimize a much more aggressive use of U.S. military force around the world. And the first clue that was the sort of thing Madeleine Albright supported comes in this story that was widely reported. I mean, it was reported by Colin Powell himself that when he was still the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and he was meeting with the Clinton transition team, at the end of one of the meetings, Madeleine Albright took him aside and sort of confronted him on what was known as the Powell Doctrine. It was really more legitimately called the Weinberger Doctrine after Powell's mentor, Caspar Weinberger. Mm. But essentially, you know, it laid down a number of rules, you know, before which, you know, a number of criteria that would have to be met before the U.S. engaged in the use of military force. And, you know, those involved having, you know, a clear exit strategy, having, you know, certainty of being able to win militarily, and, you know, a number of things that really limited the use of U.S. military force. And so what Albright said to Colin Powell at that point was, what's the good of having this wonderful military you're always talking about if we're not allowed to use it? And so then in her roles as UN ambassador and then as Secretary of State, essentially she went about, you know, doing away with that very, you know, limited doctrine of when the U.S. should use military force, and in fact became an advocate for the use of military force, you know, way beyond what is permitted under the United Nations Charter, which actually prohibits the threat and use of military force by individual countries or coalitions of countries. It limits. It actually prohibits the threat and use of military force, and you know, the only sort of exceptions it carves out are for when the UN Security Council agrees that the use of force is absolutely necessary, quote, to restore international peace and security.
Mm-hmm.
And Hillary Clinton has made similar statements. She, when she was running for the Senate in the year 2000, addressed the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, which is the state where she was running for the Senate. And she also derided the Powell Doctrine, referring to it as a doctrine that limited the use of U.S. military force to waging splendid little wars. These splendid little wars, in other words, operations like invading Grenada and Panama and, you know, reinvading Kuwait to kick the Iraqis out, you know, these are tiny little countries, you know, with populations, you know, of no more than several million. And in fact, if any of your listeners who've really studied studied U.S. foreign policy since World War II will know these are actually the only wars that the U.S. can really claim to have won since 1945. So the idea that, you know, the U.S. is setting its sights too low by saying that, you know, those were the only situations in which it would use military force, are really, really very dangerous, because at the time the U.S. has actually tried to expand its military force beyond those kind of situations, it's ended in disaster. You know, whether you're talking about Korean War that killed several million people, the Vietnam War that killed several million people, or the wars U.S. has launched since 2001,
yes,
that by very conservative estimates have killed about 1.6 million people.
And so, the question is...
This is not, you know, the rules of international law, you know, the UN Charter and doctrines that limit the use of U.S. military force, you know, are nothing to be sneezed at or derided by U.S. officials like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it's interesting that, it seems like many people want to get beyond what was called the Vietnam syndrome, say, yeah, we're tough, we can win, we can, as Albright said, what's the use of having military power if you don't use it? And it does, we're getting a picture that that's where Hillary Clinton is as well. Every, I think, political analyst realizes and agrees that Hillary Clinton is, to the right, much more militaristic than Obama, who can be criticized, I think, for the projection of military power and making the situation with ISIS work. But you talk a bit about the UN Security Council enabling and putting its stamp of approval on things like humanitarian interventionism, which brings us to the issue of her husband, Bill Clinton. He initiated the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, I believe it was, in which Albright favored, but the UN Security Council opposed. Do we know what Hillary's role may or may not have been with regard to her husband Bill Clinton's foreign policies in the bombing and invasion of Kosovo, and how did that splendid little war work out? Well, you know, the tension between Albright and Bill Clinton and the UN Security Council. Tell us a bit about the outcomes of that, and was it a good thing? I think most Americans think, yeah, we did the right thing there by protecting the people of Kosovo.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can get to that in a minute, but first, in terms of the UN Security Council,
yes,
when the world leaders came together in San Francisco in 1945 and cemented what had really been President Franklin Roosevelt's vision for the post-Cold War world, the centerpiece of it really was the agreement, you know, the determination that after two world wars, and now, of course, you know, the advent of nuclear weapons, it was simply unthinkable that the world could carry on that way. You know, because another world war might be the last. And, you know, and the wars they already had killed, you know, something in the order of 60 million people. And so the centerpiece of the UN Charter is that the countries of the world agree to settle their differences by peaceful means. And it goes on to say that for that reason, the threat and use of force is prohibited.
Realistic here, it has happened many times. The UN prohibition on that, I don't think, has ever been applied, really.
It has happened many times. But, you know, when you go back to Korea and Vietnam, I mean, those wars were the result of the division of those countries at the end of World War II,
yes,
which then created a somewhat phony situation but where, at least in terms of international law, the U.S. could claim to be, you know, defending one country against another country.
Right.
You know, South Korea against North Korea, South Vietnam against North Korea. Of course, you know, Vietnam was only supposed to be temporarily divided by the 1954 Geneva Accords. That wasn't, you know, South Vietnam and North Vietnam were not supposed to even be countries.
Right.
It was supposed to be a temporary division of one country.
Right.
But it sort of it put the U.S. in this position of, you know, being able to claim that it was defending one country against the aggression of another country.
But back to Kosovo. Kosovo.
When you come to the post-Cold War world, you know, I mean, the U.S. had conducted these invasions of Grenada and Panama, you know, both without the approval of the UN Security Council. Those were violations of the UN.
And so what?
Really no,
I mean,
no question about that.
But so, can you hear me? So, I mean, the point is, so what? We won. You know, we won those two wars. And Kosovo, did we or did we not make things better for the people in that area, despite the fact that, it, I mean, let's look at, you know, it seems sort of...
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, Kosovo is still a complete mess today. What do we know? 17 years later, 16 years later. No, the U.S. intervened on behalf of something called the Kosovo Liberation Army, which had been funded by the CIA and by European intelligence agencies, essentially to stir up trouble in this province of Yugoslavia, you know, that had a majority Albanian Muslim population. You know, the Kosovo Liberation Army was, you know, what we would probably now refer to as a terrorist organization. It was also involved in organized crime, you know, all the usual things, drug smuggling, prostitution, and things like that. And the way the Yugoslav authorities responded to it was with, you know, severe repression. And they, you know, they... Of course, the Kosovo Liberation Army was quite well armed, thanks to its Western friends, and so things were turning pretty violent. But and of course, there was already a history in Yugoslavia, you know, including Srebrenica and Sarajevo, and there was a political narrative by which to say that, oh yes, well, you know, the West should intervene and, you know, stop the violence that's taking place. And of course, by then, you know, Milosevic was a, you know, typically demonized, you know, enemy of the U.S. And so, as with Putin today or Assad today or, you know, Saddam Hussein before, you know, Milosevic was somebody who the U.S. could easily politically paint as the villain of the piece.
Sure.
And politically justify a military intervention.
And getting it back to
that military intervention was a violation of the UN Security Council.
Getting it back to Hillary Clinton, please, if we could. I want to keep the focus on Hillary Clinton's policy. We're trying to look into Hillary Clinton.
Right.
What did she know?
Is that she called up, she said in a magazine interview later, she called up her husband from a trip she was on in Africa, and in her own words, she said, "I urged him to bomb." She said, "You cannot let this go on. At the end of a century that has seen the major Holocaust of our time, what do we have nature for if not to defend our way of life?" And of course, there was no attack on a NATO member involved here. That was, you know, again, it's politically using this kind of language to justify a violation of international law. And
going back before that, just seeing, because it seems like there's no break in tradition. The neocons, the infamous group of people under Presidents Bush and Cheney, they were only too happy to exert unilateral power, to have, you know, projection of power. And as you write,
right,
they were for unbridled expansion of U.S. military power. And their goals were
right
to politically legitimize U.S. hegemony in the post-Cold Well, let me finish, please. Their goals were to politically legitimize U.S. hegemony in the post-Cold War area.
Right.
Questions are, how has this worked out for American security? Whether or not it's right or wrong, immoral or anything like that, how has it worked out for American security? Second part of that question is, how does this approach, the approach of unbridled expansion of U.S. military power, how does that compare with that of candidate Hillary Clinton?
Well, she has been intimately involved in it right the way through, from what Madeleine Albright called her unprecedented partnership with the First Lady during her tenure as Secretary of State, Albright, I mean, and to Hillary Clinton approving the invasion of Iraq in a way that the people who had worked with her in the Clinton White House were not surprised. James Rubin, who was Albright's spokesperson and personal assistant and when she was Secretary of State, you know, he in interviews has said he was not surprised at all by Clinton's vote for the war in Iraq, because to him, it seems consistent with the views of the Clinton administration, of Bill Clinton, of Madeleine Albright, and of Hillary Clinton. Because, you know, none of them actually upheld the UN Charter or the rule of international law.
Forget, that's never going to be applied by the
US. They all were involved in rationalizing, you know, the expansion of U.S. military.
And my question is, how does this, the neocons under Bush and Cheney, how does that, is there a break or is a continuation between them and the policy of Hillary Clinton?
Well, I would say that the goals of the neocons and the goals of the humanitarian interventionists, if you want to call them that,
mm-hmm,
or liberal interventionists, as Robert Kagan now calls it,
mm-hmm,
their goals were essentially the same, but they were both looking for ways to rationalize the military-industrial complex and the expansion of U.S. military power in the post-Cold War world. Now, one did it by claiming that, oh, well, you know, we had a responsibility to protect. We need to, you know, to go and stop things like the genocide in Rwanda, which, by the way,
right,
when it was happening, neither Albright or Clinton or any of these people lifted a finger. It was only in hindsight that they saw, you know, a way to spin this politically to, you know, to justify future intervention. And now, you know, Rwanda, every time there is a discussion of U.S. intervention somewhere, you know, they raise the specter of Rwanda, where in fact, of course, they did nothing. So, in a sense, Rwanda has become the dog that didn't bark. And we've ended up with the sort of worst-case scenario and, you know, in one or two, you know, very rare situations in which it's remotely conceivable, or although very questionable, that some kind of intervention might have, you know, slightly reduced the bloodshed. Now, in every other intervention, that is used, in every other situation, that's used as a pretext before intervention. And the results of all those interventions are now clear to see. We have about a dozen countries just plunged into violence and chaos. We have, as I said, at least 1.6 million people killed in these U.S.-led wars since 2001. And, you know, and really with no end in sight. I mean...
And I wonder how...
Islamic jihadism is still expanding.
Oh, yeah.
It keeps morphing into more dangerous forms. I mean, Al-Qaeda was dangerous enough, but now we have Islamic State. You know, what if we keep fighting fire with fire,
right?
You know, what is the next mutation going to look?
Well, one question is, all right, we've had President Obama in between Bush, Cheney, and the next president. And I wonder how a lot of people, I mean, let's face it, Obama, at least with most Democrats, is pretty popular. His foreign policy, I like to think it was somewhat of a break with the expansionist neocon Bush Cheney era. But then again, you know, he's relied on drones a lot, which have killed lots of innocent people and been a tremendous recruiting tool for ISIS. No question about that. So if people say, well, we liked Obama, let's continue with the Obama legacy. Is that Hillary Clinton? It sounds like it may be.
Well, I think she was involved really as being, as I explained in my article, really the most hawkish member of Obama's foreign policy advisors.
Yes.
But the Obama administration has used force more on with a humanitarian interventionist rationale than with a neocon rationale. However, I think what I would say is that when Obama came into office, a lot of the changes in U.S. policy and U.S. militarism were already taking place at the end of the Bush administration. There was, you know, this expansion of the use of drones, massive expansion of U.S. special forces and Joint Special Operations Command, which are essentially death squads who we send into countries to conduct secret assassinations and targeted killings.
So it sounds like the basic thing is that there's not exactly a straight line from Bush and Cheney through Obama to Hillary Clinton, but not really much of a break.
There was no clean break.
No.
And that is the problem. That is why the chaos and the violence has continued.
Yeah.
There was no clean break. There was an evolution, if you like, and also a great deal of political opportunism on the part of Obama and Clinton to essentially take U.S. war-making farther into the shadows in many respects. Even in the war we all know about in Afghanistan, which Obama massively escalated and got at least another 1,700 Americans killed, and he came to rely very heavily in Afghanistan on drone strikes, airstrikes. He maintained about 5,000 airstrikes a year. That's about 100 airstrikes a year throughout most of his presidency in Afghanistan, about 100 a week, 5,000 a year. He conducted a massive expansion of special operations forces night raids in Afghanistan.
So basically, if you like...
From where it was sort of one a night to, you know, 30 or 40 a night.
So basically, if you like Obama's foreign policy, massive intervention foreign policy, heck, what the hell? Might as well go with Hillary Clinton. It's more of the same. And speaking of more of the same, I do find it fascinating that Secretary of State Clinton employed two of Dick Cheney's people as her close aides, Victoria Nuland and her husband, Robert Kagan. Please tell us a bit about who they are and about their legacy on places like Ukraine and Eastern Europe, other hotspots that we haven't talked about yet. T- Tell us about Newland and Kagan.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the only holdovers from the Bush administration. Obviously, you know, there are whole bureaucracies at the State Department and especially the Department of Defense and the CIA, you know, where a lot of these, you know, inner circle policy people, you know, quite senior
policy. Same old, same old, yep.
Move pretty smoothly from Democratic to Republican administrations and back again. But in particular, yeah, I mean, Robert Kagan and his wife, Victoria Nuland. I mean, Robert Kagan was really one of the architects of neoconservatism. I mean, he and William Kristol were the co-founders of the Project for the New American Century when it was formed in 1997. At the end of the Bush administration, he went to work for the Brookings Institution, a generally democratic-oriented, supposedly liberal think tank, which is nonetheless funded, gets enormous funding from U.S. Weapons companies and other parts of the military-industrial complex. And so he's now employed by the Brookings Institution. And
what's his relationship with Hillary Clinton?
He was appointed by Hillary Clinton in 2011 to sit on this foreign policy board that she formed. This is a group of about 20 or 30, you know, experts who advise the Secretary of State on U.S. foreign policy. They meet around a table and discuss, you know, the deep issues of U.S. foreign policy. And here we have, you know, one of the co-founders of the Project for the New American Century sitting on that board. I mean, he's still there under John Kerry.
And what about Victoria Nuland?
Likewise, his wife, who was, you know, the assistant foreign policy advisor to Dick Cheney when he was vice president. She was then appointed U.S. ambassador to NATO. When the Obama administration came in, she again moved very smoothly to become Hillary Clinton's spokesperson at the State Department. And then once Hillary Clinton stepped down and John Kerry brought in his own spokesperson, he promoted Victoria Nuland to be the Assistant Secretary for Eurasian Affairs. In other words, over, you know, all U.S. foreign policy in Europe and Asia. If there was truly, you know, deep ideological difference or a fundamental difference in the goals of U.S. foreign policy under, you know, the Obama administration and the Bush administration.
Right, but there isn't.
And, you know, they would not be sitting there listening to the same people and putting these people in positions of responsibility and power over U.S. foreign policy. And the result of, Victoria Nuland's appointment to be Undersecretary of State is that she then essentially planned and organized a coup in Ukraine.
Yeah.
This doctrine of covert and proxy force, you know, that the Obama administration has used to take U.S. policy further into the shadows and to avoid putting U.S. boots
right
on the ground
right
in many of these places.
Right.
And yet the results are just as destructive. I mean,
yes.
Ukraine is just a complete basket case now, riven by civil war. Its economy has shrunk by, you know, something like 40 or 50% since the coup.
Hmm. So if you like that policy, she's got more of it. And certainly Putin and Russia are quite right to be afraid of the expansion of NATO. NATO was not supposed to be expanded, and it has expanded very much. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest today is Nicholas J.S. Davies, author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. We're talking about Hillary Clinton. What is her foreign policy? What should we expect from the past to see what she might be? And we're trying to examine that. And, you know, just does it serve the United States? Robert Gates was Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2011. And before that, he headed up the CIA. No one could call him a starry-eyed, unrealistic pacifist. Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense. What has he said about Hillary Clinton in his book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of War?
Well, he makes it very clear that she was consistently the most hawkish member of Obama's cabinet. You know, she supported, in fact, an even greater escalation of the war in Afghanistan than what Obama eventually authorized. She was really the decisive voice in arguing for intervention in Libya.
Yes.
And in fact, Robert Gates himself, the Republican holdover as Secretary of Defense, he was so opposed at that point to getting the U.S. involved, yet another war and yet another country, that he considered resigning over you know, the operation in Libya. And the other people in Obama's circle who supported it were more junior people. They were people like Samantha Power, who was a member of the National Security Council at that point, and Susan Rice, who was the UN ambassador. Nobody was, you know, at the senior level for it, except for Clinton. And Obama told Gates afterwards that, in his mind, it was 51-49 decision.
Right.
So Obama was so undecided himself, really, you know, Clinton on the pro-intervention side, it almost certainly would not have happened. And it's very unlikely that the Europeans, you know, in spite of Sarkozy's bellicosity, very likely that, you know, France and Britain and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Qatar would have gone ahead and done this without the U.S. being part of it. You know, even though the French and the British just did a majority of the actual airstrikes, you know, there was a U.S. aircraft carrier off the coast the entire time with, you know, a war room that was the central, you know, central HQ for the entire Western and Arab monarchist military operation. The CIA had people on the ground. There was U.S. satellite intelligence being used. And, of course, British and the French had special forces on the ground. You know, this image we got of these ragtag Libyan rebels racing across the country all on their own, you know, with only Western air support, was a myth.
Yes, of course.
There were Qatari special forces on the ground, most of whom are not Qatari, most of whom are Pakistani mercenaries.
Mercenaries, of course. And we, you know,
and
Libya has opened up.
The British and the French had people on the ground too.
Libya has opened up for ISIS. Libya is just incredibly out of control. And I've heard a lot of people who defend Hillary Clinton saying, look, this was Obama's decision. You can't blame it on her. But as you said, she apparently was the decisive voice in the attack on Libya. Now, some Democrats who are supporting her candidacy say, just leave well enough alone, that looking at her record appears to be unnecessary bashing of our likely nominee. What's your response to that, Nicholas?
Well, I didn't write the article to bash Hillary Clinton. I wrote the article to once again lay out what I see as the fundamentally disastrous direction that U.S. foreign policy took at the end of the second, at the end of the Cold War. But to explore just exactly how she has been involved in that, and how much she actually supports that. Because in my view, we do need a clean break from, you know, the militarism, from the record military budgets, which have been even higher overall under Obama than
they
under
have.
Bush.
Yep, they have.
And what's clear to me in looking at Hillary Clinton's record and her own stated views is that we will not get a clean break. And so, you know, what we will get is more of the same.
Yep.
We will get more of an ever-escalating war that is affecting more and more countries, plunging more and more countries into chaos, fueling terrorism, fueling the rot of forces that only become harder to control and harder to deal with the longer this goes on.
Yeah. So it seems
incredibly dangerous, and overhanging all of this is a new Cold War between the United States and Russia, which also Clinton is absolutely part of.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Well, thank you so much. We are at a time where we can make a choice here. More of the same. If you want more of the same, you got Hillary Clinton. A change would be Bernie Sanders, who I think is the strongest candidate to beat Donald Trump when people really do want more of the change. Our guest today on Keeping Democracy Alive has been Nicholas J.S. Davies, author of the critically acclaimed Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Bert. I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
All right. There are lives in the balance.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.